Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, December 2nd, 2016, during a live courthouse steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members.
Welcome to the Federal Society's courthouse steps telephone conference call. This afternoon, we will be discussing the recent Supreme Court oral arguments in Moore v. Texas. My name is Nate Kazmarek. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. And today we welcome our expert, Kent Scheidegger, who is the Legal Director and General Counsel at the Criminal Justice Legal Foundation. Today I will turn it over to Kent to get us started. Following opening remarks, we will open the floor for audience questions. So please think of questions that you would like to ask Kent. Thank you for speaking with us, Kent. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much. This case involves Bobby James Moore, who is a habitual criminal, and he and two accomplices robbed a supermarket in Houston, Texas. Moore was armed with a shotgun. A surviving employee of the store testified that Moore blew the head off James McCarble, a 70-year-old employee of the store who was offering no resistance. The case involves the exemption from the death penalty for intellectually disabled persons, and understanding that issue requires more than the usual amount of background, so I hope you'll bear with me for a rather extended explanation. The United States Supreme Court has not been consistent in its decisions regarding what the Constitution requires when a capital defendant claims to be intellectually disabled, a condition formerly known as mentally retarded. In the 1976 case of Jurek v. Texas, the High Court upheld the Texas statute, which made the sentence depend on the jury's answers to three special issues, none of which specifically addressed retardation or even mitigation in the broad sense. In 1989, in the case of Penry v. Linaw, the High Court decided that the Eighth Amendment does not require a categorical exemption from capital punishment for the mentally retarded, but does require the jury to be instructed to consider that circumstance as mitigating. In the 2002 case of Atkins v. Virginia, the Supreme Court changed its mind yet again and decided that a constitutional exclusion is required, effectively deciding that even mild mental retardation necessarily outweighs all aggravating circumstances, regardless of how heinous. The Atkins decision did not define mental retardation. The decision did refer to two definitions widely used at the time. One was the ninth edition of the manual published by the American Association on Mental Retardation, and the other was the fourth edition of the American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, known as the DSM-IV for short. In the end, though, the Atkins Court said that, as with insanity, it left to the states the task of developing appropriate ways to enforce the restriction. 2 years after Atkins, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, which is the highest court for criminal cases in that state, implemented the decision in Ex parte Briceño. That court decided that until the Texas legislature specified a definition for capital cases, it would use the definition of retardation in the Health and Safety Code, which was substantially the same as the ninth edition of the AAMR manual. That definition has three components. First, the defendant must have significantly subaverage general intellectual functioning, with significantly subaverage defined as two standard deviations below the mean, which corresponds to an IQ of 70 or below. Second, the defendant must have related deficits in adaptive functioning. Third, the onset must have occurred prior to the age of 18. That is, brain damage or other events occurring in adulthood do not constitute retardation. Given the subjectivity of the adaptive deficits prong, the court also set out a list of seven factors to be considered, and this list of so-called Briceño factors has been the source of much controversy. The list includes such things as whether people who knew the defendant during his developmental period considered him to be retarded, and whether the commission of the offense itself required forethought. In the introductory portion of the opinion, the Briceño court mentioned in passing the character Lenny from John Steinbeck's novel Of Mice and Men. Lenny is not mentioned again in the opinion, and nothing in the opinion states that any part of the test is based on Lenny, regardless of what you may have read in the New York Times. In the course of review of Moore's first death sentence, he was evaluated by a defense psychological expert who diagnosed him as not retarded, but instead as borderline intellectual functioning. That sentence was overturned on other grounds, and Moore was resentenced in the interval between Penry and Atkins. Although he had the right to claim retardation as a mitigating circumstance if his lawyers believed he actually was retarded, they chose not to make that argument or to offer any evidence of retardation. On the contrary, the defense expert testified that Moore was, quote, nowhere near retarded, unquote. Habeas corpus proceedings in state court reviewing the second death sentence occurred after Atkins, and after both of the organizations noted in that case had published new manuals with new definitions. The AAMR renamed itself the American Association on Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities, or AAIDD, and its new standard omitted the requirement that the adaptive deficits be related to the subaverage intellectual functioning. The same expert who previously testified Moore was not retarded now said he did qualify as intellectually disabled. The trial judge applied the new AAIDD standard and made a finding that Moore was intellectually disabled. The Texas Court of Criminal Appeals found that it was error to apply that new standard rather than the definition established in its precedents. Applying the definition of Briseño to the facts of the case, the court found that Moore is not intellectually disabled. Moore petitioned the U.S. Supreme Court for writ of certiorari. And in his petition, he asked the Supreme Court to decide whether a state can, quote, prohibit the use of current medical standards on intellectual disability and require the use of outdated standards, unquote. That would be a pure question of law, and it would not depend on the facts of the Moore case, and it would extend far beyond Texas, given that a number of other states have also not adopted the new definitions. However, in Tuesday's argument, Clifford Sloan, the attorney for Moore, began his argument with a list of complaints about the particular rules in Texas. Chief Justice Roberts immediately criticized this laundry list, as he called it, and noted that the court had agreed to take the case solely on the question of old versus new standards. Justice Kennedy also raised that issue and noted that the question presented does not cut to the heart of the case, as counsel for petitioner had described it. Even so, much of the argument that followed focused on the additional Briseño factors and whether they conformed to the clinical definitions in effect at the time Atkins was decided. There was considerable skepticism from the justices about these factors and whether they operated to reduce the class of murderers exempted from capital punishment to a considerably smaller group than would have been recognized as retarded, even under the old standards. At one point in his initial argument, Sloan appeared to concede that the state could use the DSM-4 rather than the DSM-5. Texas Solicitor General Scott Keller pounced on this during his argument, saying that the petitioner had conceded the question he asked the court to decide, and that should be sufficient to resolve the case. In his rebuttal argument, however, Sloan denied that he had conceded this point. From the overall tone of the argument, it appears that Moore may win a remand to reconsider his intellectual disability argument, and the Supreme Court may disapprove the non-clinical Briseño factors. However, it appears unlikely that the court is going to hand down the kind of sweeping rule that the original question presented seemed to ask for, requiring states to adopt each new definition that private organizations come out with. In my view, delegating the definition of a constitutional standard to private organizations would be a problematic and unwise step. Both of the organizations in here are advocacy organizations. The American Association on Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities frankly admits to being an advocacy organization. And the American Psychiatric Association is one in reality, invariably taking the defense side in criminal matters. The states of the union should not be required to dance to their tune, and it does not appear that the Supreme Court is poised to require that, at least as to changes that have been made since the Atkins decision. But we will find out in a few months. Thank you.
Thank you, Kent. Would you like to take audience questions at this time?
Yes, we can take questions.
Very good. I will now open the floor for questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone. When we get to your request, you'll hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone keypad. Kent, one of the questions I had, I know it's difficult or problematic to try to guess the outcome of a case based on oral argument, but did you have any thoughts or reflections on how Justice Scalia's absence may impact the ultimate outcome in this case, if at all?
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt that Justice Scalia would have voted for the state had he been still on the court. The whole line of cases on which this is based is something he very much disagreed with. His absence may result, I think the court will want to avoid a 4-4 split, which basically leaves the entire question up in the air. So there may be a narrower decision than otherwise would have come out of the case. But we'll see when they come out with a decision.
Okay. Currently, our lines are wide open. Again, if you'd like to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone keypad. One programming note, our next Teleform conference call is scheduled for Monday, December 5th at 3 p.m. That call will also be a Courthouse Steps edition discussing the Supreme Court's Monday morning oral arguments in two redistricting cases, Bethune Hill versus Virginia State Board of Elections and McCrory v. Harris. That call will feature Maya Naranja, who is an associate with Baker and Hostetler. Kent, it doesn't appear that we have any questions pending at this time. Is there any sort of further discussion you'd like to add, or if not, any concluding remarks you'd like to offer to our audience?
Well, I did notice during the argument Justice Kagan seemed to be particularly convinced that the Texas Briseño standard did not even conform to the standards in effect at the time Atkins was decided. That may end up being the position that they can get five votes to agree on. We'll have to see how that comes out. And of course, there's always some possibility they may split 4-4 and wait for the appointment and confirmation of a ninth justice. So it is always very dicey to predict from oral argument.
Absolutely, but we very much appreciate your insights today. Just a reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming Teleform calls. You can also consult our full schedule of upcoming Teleform conference calls on the Federal Society's website, fedsoc.org. There are podcasts of previously recorded calls. I'll just give one last call for questions. Seeing none, Kent, I think we will conclude. On behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank you for joining us today. We welcome listener feedback at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.